Now it's my pleasure to cross to Ruth Wasserman, who is on the line from Israel. She's a former Israeli member of Knesset, co-founder of the Abraham Accords Caucus, and a prominent advocate for Arab-Israeli cooperation. Although she was born in Israel, she spent her schooling years in Cape Town at Herzliya, and she returned to Israel on her own at the age of 17. She's also served as deputy ambassador to Egypt, was an advisor to President Shimon Peres, and today she heads a strategic consultancy and serves in senior roles in global Jewish diplomacy. Ruth, it's a pleasure to have you on the Home Run. Thanks so much for joining us. You're a strong voice for Jewish-Arab coexistence. After the horrors of October 7th and the Gaza War, how do you still advocate for Arab engagement without alienating Israelis who...
So first of all, it's a pleasure to be on your platform. Thank you so much for having me. And yes, there are very many challenges and a lot of skepticism, particularly following the October 7th horrors. And although we need to stay hopeful and, of course, to keep an open mind, for example, as happens within the Abraham Accords, I would say alliances and countries, this is met with a lot of skepticism, by the way, not only from the Israeli side, but also from the other side that gets fed a lot of disinformation, a lot of incitement, and so on in the Arab world, because a lot of the media is very one-sided. And of course, and unfortunately, there's a shortage of explanation of the narrative on the part of Israel as well. So there's a lot of skepticism on both sides. And of course, and I feel quite legitimately so, on the Israeli side, because of what had happened and because of the feeling that there's a lot of hatred, a lot of indoctrination, part of which led also to the horrors that were perpetrated in October 2023.
Ruth, with Saudi Arabia reportedly edging closer to normalization, do you believe it will formally join the Abraham Accords anytime soon? And what are the roadblocks behind the scenes?
So I was always a propagator. In fact, I created the first of its kind Abraham Accords caucus in any parliament in the world. It was in the Knesset, after which one was formed in the American Congress and, of course, in the House of Lords and House of Commons in the United Kingdom. However, I think that despite the fact that Saudi Arabia is very keen to come forward and to align itself with Israel and with the United States in the Abraham Accords for its own interests, which is completely legitimate, there are, as you call them, roadblocks or challenges. For example, the possibility of such countries having access to nuclear capabilities, even for civilian purposes, and or certain cutting-edge technology in terms of warfare, and or the establishment of a Palestinian state, which for Israelis in the current situation is almost a red flag, given the fact that with the experiences of a huge amount of terrorism in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, there's been a huge amount of skepticism on the part of actually the vast majority of Israelis concerning the establishment of a Palestinian state at this point. So there are obstacles, there are roadblocks, and there are challenges to such agreements, and it needs to be seen how these will be clarified.
The countries that signed the Abraham Accords, the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, Morocco, did the war in Gaza that followed October the 7th and the Iran-Israel war that seems to be over, that lasted 12 days, did those two wars put them in a difficult position? And if so, did it in any way challenge the Abraham Accords?
So it would be completely wrong to say that nothing affected and there were no challenges. First and foremost, a population that was taught for decades that Israel was, even perhaps not an enemy, but definitely not a friend, needs to be changed. And that takes time. It takes years. It takes fruits of cooperation that need to become very tangible to a population in order to create a real and in-depth change over time. So that alone is a challenge. But of course, that with all of the disinformation and all of the media coverage of Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and other networks and social media from a number of Arab countries throughout the Middle East, and that's what is being fed to the vast majority of citizens throughout the Arab world, throughout the Gulf region, and so on, because there's almost nothing else to counter that. There's no explanation of any narrative, or I would say there's almost none at all to counter that. That's what the civilians in the United Arab Emirates, in Morocco, in the other places, that's what they get, that's what they see. And of course, it creates a certain kind of a perception, and it molds one's perception, and that perception is naturally extraordinarily negative and serves the purposes of countries like Qatar and others. And it does affect the level of cooperation that can be explored and followed between Israel and Israelis and civilians of that country. It all depends on two basic things. One, will the state of Israel and or any actors on its behalf provide any kind of counter arguments, which very little of it is in place, unfortunately. What we like to call hasbara, but it's, you know, it's not a good word to describe the presentation of a narrative. So they only get one side. And the second thing is, how determined, how committed is a government of a country to the agreement? And I must say that Bahrain and Morocco and the United Arab Emirates, Sudan is a different story because it is infiltrated by a lot of Iranian influence, not to mention others. And really, there's a lot of strife and internal warring there, a lot of illegal practices bordering on terrorism and so on. So it's very different. But other countries, for example, like United Arab Emirates and others, they are certainly committed and determined to stand by those agreements. And therefore, it makes a huge difference, because despite the lows and the highs, and God knows there were many, they maintain the agreement because of interests, because of economy, because of their relationship with the United States, but also because they've made a brave and courageous decision to go forward with it and to create fruit from it. And I respect that, and that works. Does it have problems? Yes. Is it being maintained nonetheless? Also, yes.
Ruth, you've worked closely with Arab leaders. Have you seen any shift in how they view Hamas since the war in Gaza? Are they more open to engaging with Israel now, or are they more cautious?
So the issue in Gaza has created a huge challenge for Arab governments. One, because most of them are very afraid of this instability and terrorism leaking into their own borders. For example, Egypt and Jordan would be very good examples of that. Two, the issue of the Palestinian question, because of the very high level of, I would say, indoctrination / incitement / disinformation, which is extremely one-sided, that has been literally pushed down the throats of the world and the globe in general, and the Arab countries in particular, these governments have a challenge vis-a-vis their own populations, because they are supposed to sort of answer to, if that's the case on the Palestinian aside, then why are you cooperating with who's perpetrating these horrors against the Palestinians? They don't have the other side, the other narrative, the counter side. And this is a challenge that they've been faced with. Now, different governments deal with it in a different way, because for all of the governments, no matter if it's Egypt, Jordan, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and so on, siding with Hamas, seeing what Hamas has done, understanding that this is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, they completely understand that this is a challenge and a threat to their own stability and their own continuity and their own regimes as well. There's no question of that. In fact, Hamas is outlawed in all of those countries, whether it's called Hamas or Muslim Brotherhood, completely outlawed. Whereas in Europe, there are, you know, offered refuge and openness. There are the most number of membership of Hamas and Muslim Brotherhood in Canada. In Arab countries like the ones that I've mentioned, in fact, Hamas and like-minded organizations are completely outlawed. And there is a fear and there is a kind of a huge skepticism and caution of Hamas. And despite that, they do not want to appear very one-sided towards Israel and seemingly against the Palestinian people who are indeed suffering under the Hamas rule, and because of what was perpetrated, many of them perpetrated with their leadership, but certainly not every single one of them, but they are viewed as suffering, and therefore these governments are also cautious as to not to create a kind of a rift between the general perception of their own publics and their stances. And they find themselves very often in a difficult or challenging position. Situation.